actually moving the goalpost, even as we define issues. We've seen this a lot in the immigration battle, right? That we name specific demands, and we bring them to our decision makers, and that by the time the discussion starts, the goalpost has been moved because people on the right have reframed the conversation around some other kind of threat, like people bringing drugs into the country, you know, so that suddenly we're unprepared to deal with something that has been raised that might be a complete red herring, but is nonetheless starting to define the debate.
All right. It is 30 seconds before 6 p.m. And I have to say, this is the end of the KBOO Evening News for tonight. I want to thank Scott Nakagawa, our live guest. Really appreciate your time.
Real quick, Thanks. Can we give out his website?
It's Please
change,
do.
ChangeLab.com. Oh, sorry, ChangeLabInfo.com.
ChangeLabInfo.com. A lot of writing on there. Jenna Yokoyama, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kanan Schlesinger.
Been a wild ride.
And our engineer, Sequoia Wright. It's 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven in Portland. Oddville, a new vaudevillian tradition, is a brand new variety show style monthly night, taking cues from vaudevillian traditions and narrative comedy. Each month's showcase features a different lineup of performers, bringing together a wide range of artistic disciplines and focusing on polished short pieces from our thriving clown, circus, vaudevillian, and alternative performance communities right here in Portland. Again, that's Oddville, March 13th at 7 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, 1464 Southeast 2nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Fade to Black, a book release event for political prisoner Jalil Muntakam on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. This political education and community event will promote the recent book release of Escaping the Prison, Fade to Black. Jalil is a political prisoner who organized with the Black Panther Party in the Bay Area and was underground with the Black Liberation Army. He was captured when he was 19 in 1971 and has been locked up ever since. This event will feature local talent and activists including Black Butterfly, Kent Ford, Walida Imarisha, and many more. Again, that's Fade to Black, a book release event for political prisoner Jalil Muntakam on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center, 400 Southeast 12th in Portland.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is KBOO Portland.
This song goes out to the new slaves, the new blacks, new Jews, the new minorities for whom we need a civil rights movement.
Going uptown to Harlem, gonna let my hair down in Harlem.
On the side of my eye, gonna go up to Harlem
and have a good time.
I got too many clothes to find a place in the closet, hands out in the light. I am exemplary.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Indonesia's anti-queer crackdown worsens. LGBT youth activists close in on Harlem homophobe, and Kenyan rappers face showdown over equal love videos. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 27th, 2016. LGBT lives are quite literally being threatened now in the world's fourth most populous nation, Indonesia. We updated you last week about the bans on pro-LGBT content on TV and social media, and about the country's leading Muslim clerics calling for same-gender lovemaking to be outlawed. More followers of Mohammed live in Indonesia than anywhere else on the planet. The country's former Information and Communications Minister and current MP, Tifatul Sembering, said in a tweet on February 26 that Islam calls for the execution of gay people. A saying of the Prophet, he wrote, referencing Sodom and Gomorrah, "Whomever you find committing the acts of the community of Lot should be put to death." He soon deleted the tweet after a hail of criticism. One religious scholar suggested that Sembering was importing the rhetoric of the Islamic State, which brags about killing gay men.
The Indonesian Psychiatrists Association jumped in with a declaration of its own this week that homosexuality and gender dysphoria are mental disorders that can be cured with proper treatment. In the city of Yogyakarta, Indonesia's only Islamic school for transgender women was shut down on February 25th. Police officials had banned a rally at the Yogyakarta Monument planned by Democracy Struggle Solidarity, an LGBT support group, 2 days earlier.
Earlier in the week, Defense Minister Riamizat Riyakudu called LGBT people more dangerous than nuclear war because, he told the Tempo News website, "We can't see who our foes are, but out of the blue, everyone is brainwashed." The assault on LGBT people began in January, with Higher Education Minister Muhammad Nasir reacting to the formation of an unauthorized support group for sexual minorities at the University of Indonesia. He called for a ban on all-out LGBT students because their existence violates the nation's standards and morals.
Analysts can't explain the rapid upsurge in anti-LGBT abuse, but Agence France-Presse reported that it follows a push by religious leaders and conservative politicians to bolster public morality in Indonesia, with crackdowns on prostitution and the availability of drugs and alcohol. LGBT activists also say that the advent of marriage equality in the United States last June has heightened fears by some government officials that similar efforts will be launched in Indonesia, even though LGBT people have no rights at all in the country. Some equality activists are pinning their hopes on President Joko Widodo, who earned the backing of most LGBT people after promising to address human rights abuses and champion minority groups. But he's been silent so far.
Sexual minorities continue to be robbed of their dignity in Russia. Any public expression of support for LGBT rights is already criminalized in the country, with the blessing of President Vladimir Putin. The Ministry of Health this week proposed the creation of clinics throughout the country to treat LGBT people. Sexology exam rooms would address disorders of sexual preference and gender identity disorders as mental and behavioral disorders that are lumped in with pedophilia. The rooms would be located inside primary care clinics and psychiatric hospitals, and according to a government website, would be required to stock at least one dildo, although it wasn't exactly clear why.
The clinics would provide court-ordered forced treatment when necessary. They would also diagnose and treat sexual deviations among children and youth and consult youth about their sexual education and knowledge of gender. Russian Health Ministry official Georgi Gubanov, who is reportedly behind the proposal, said his agency would be taking feedback from the public before going forward. He is the same man who proposed rules last year to prevent transgender people from getting driver's licenses. While restrictions were enacted in January 2015, their practical effect has apparently been negligible. The clinic's proposal was published on February 19th, the same day that Russia lawmakers offered a brief respite from attacks on sexual minorities by rejecting a bill that would have made coming out a crime. Conversion or reparative therapy has been soundly debunked by every reputable mental health organization in the U.S. and most of the Western world.
a coalition of U.S. LGBT advocacy groups, filed a landmark consumer fraud complaint this week with the Federal Trade Commission against the Virginia-based People Can Change and all practitioners of so-called ex-gay therapy. The Human Rights Campaign, the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the Southern Poverty Law Center charge that the group preys on vulnerable LGBT people and families by using damaging and discredited claims that it can change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. The complaint alleges that People Can Change violates Federal Trade Commission guidelines by claiming that homosexuality is a mental illness and that its services have a basis in science. It's also charged with using unsubstantiated testimonials to defraud consumers. The complaint builds on arguments used in a successful lawsuit against a New Jersey group last year for making the same claims. A jury ordered that group to pay thousands of dollars in damages to former patients.
Samantha Ames is one of the attorneys with the National Center for Lesbian Rights. This historic complaint is not only the first clear opportunity the Obama administration has had to end these deadly practices for good, she said, but if investigated fully, it could very well be the final nail in the coffin of the entire conversion therapy industry.
Lawmakers in the Italian Senate dumped an adoptions provision from a civil union's proposal this week in order to get the basic partnership bill approved. The abandoned provision would simply have allowed couples in civil unions to adopt their partners' biological children. But Roman Catholic Church officials, opposed to civil unions, protested most loudly that the adoptions provision would open the door to surrogacy, which is outlawed in the country. Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has repeatedly promised to enact a civil unions bill. In a high-stakes gamble, he called a confidence vote on his leadership and legislative agenda on February 25th. If he'd lost that vote, he would have been forced to resign. The measure without the adoptions provision then passed in the Senate by a lopsided vote of 173-71 and was hailed by Renzi as historic. Some equality advocates, however, condemned it as a betrayal. Flavio Romani, president of the LGBT rights group Archigay, told Reuters that the law that has come out of all this is lacking its heart. The bill now goes to Parliament's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, where its passage is widely expected to be easy. Italy is currently the only major country in Europe without some form of legal recognition for lesbian and gay couples.
Lawmakers in Israel's parliament, the Knesset, proved this week that words can indeed be empty. They voted down several pro-LGBT bills just a day after declaring a first-ever LGBT Rights Day on February 23rd. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's ruling coalition rejected six bills proposed by the opposition that would have, among other actions, banned so-called conversion therapy for minors, created civil unions for same-gender couples, recognized a slain soldier's same-gender partner or the same-gender parents of a slain soldier, and required health professionals to learn about LGBT issues. During the debate on the bills, Health Minister Yaakov Litzman of the far-right United Torah Judaism Party said private consensual adult same-gender lovemaking was the same kind of sin as worshiping the golden calf. The Meretz party's Michael Rosen, who sponsored the bill to train health professionals to deal with LGBT issues, said Litzman was betraying his responsibility as health minister. "I didn't ask you to be minister for gays and lesbians," he said. "What you did here was neither Jewish nor humane." M.K. Zippy Livni of the Zionist Union Party told reporters that, "We will keep fighting until this government stands behind its words."
In other news, an LGBT rights group is working with Berlin's city council to open a shelter for queer Syrian refugees. Organizers say it will house at least 120 people. Stefan Jakl of the Berlin Homosexual Council told reporters that LGBT refugees need special attention because of the often violent abuse they suffer from their peers, made even worse by anti-queer authorities in migrant camps in other countries. Another organizer, Marcel de Groot, cited stories of anti-LGBT violence in Berlin shelters. "People must be able to live without fear of violence or discrimination," he said. According to Agence France-Presse, a smaller shelter, with space for 8 LGBT refugees, opened on February 1st in the southern city of Nuremberg, the first of its kind in Germany.
And finally, returning to Indonesia, Tangerang Mayor Arief Wismansia wins the prize for the most outrageous claims coming out of the escalating condemnation of LGBT people in the Muslim-majority Southeast Asian nation. He told a city-run pregnancy seminar this week that baby formula and instant noodles could make infants gay. Parents are often so busy that they only feed their children formula and instant foods, he said. So it's no wonder that recently there are more LGBT. Well, that explains it.
That's NewsWrap for the week ending February 27th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
On the menu this week, it's a Take That Bigot burger on a liberating Kenyan rap roll, starting with a new remix of Macklemore and Ryan Lewis's 2014 Grammy Best Song nominee, Same Love. Members of the musical group Art Attack could be arrested at any time, and an actor from their YouTube video has fled the country after the remix was banned by the Kenya Film Classification Board. Still, Art Attack stands by their work. As feature rapper Noti Flo said in a Facebook post, "Arrest us if you wish. We are unbowed."
This song goes out to the new slaves, the new blacks, new Jews, the new minorities for whom we need a civil rights movement. Maybe a sex rights movement, especially in Africa, everywhere. This goes out to you. I feel you. My story, y'all. My sorry story, y'all. This is me, this is you, this is us, this is the world. Wild war, cold war, love war. Uh-huh. He is back and feeling love with the making in school. Shit. He was cool, he was funny, always true, always shining. My heart told me I was right. I could go ahead and love him, I could go ahead and hug him, I could go ahead and hug him. Yeah. He was never judgmental, always stood by my side. Always there when I called him, show support when I'm falling. We spent all the days together, every weekend sharing stories. Summer, winter, every weather, life was full of all glories in his eyes. I was a sparkle and my heart was spinning circle. And one day I went and told him that I thought I was a psycho, cause I was in love with a boy like me. But he told me no one ever gave him joy like me. So he came close, switched arms and hugged me tight. And he told me never leave me, please love me right. It was strange cause I was a man just like him. I really couldn't explain it, but it just like him I did.
And I can't change, even if I tried, even if I wanted to.
Going through, I told her I love the boy and they love me too. Mommy flipping started cussing me, running to daddy, and told daddy our son's going crazy already. Our decision was a wrap too, you know what I was saying. Buck your back, shameless, hating and follow the sin. I sang down to my knees, trying to call her to mama. Mama said, I ain't your mommy, you're the son of the devil. And daddy said, go through, for a struggle, you devil. And for the last 6 years, my parents have never seen me. Every day I bleed tears, hoping that they wish to see me and die. I'm for the public cause I'm scared of the jail. Cause if they ever caught me, they would throw me in jail. You're a criminal, how dare you, falling in love. It's a crime to follow your heart and follow your love. I'm breaking the constitution, going through a segregation. Freakanization power to the black nation. Church rules, street rules, court rules, school rules. Hate is the new love. Kill me, talk tough. Homophobia is the new African culture. Everyone's the police, everyone's a cop judge. More blood, street justice. Kill them when you see them. Blame it on the West, never blame it on love. It's an Africa to try and show a brother some love.
I can't change, even if I try, even if I wanted to. My love, my love, my love, she keeps me warm. She keeps me warm. She keeps me warm. She keeps me warm.
Yeah, to my brothers, been your Vanga, Georgia.
borrow. And my lay sisters everywhere in the struggle. Always love from your heart, never love from society. The hate is too much, all in the name of piety. Uganda staying strong, Nigeria, Africa. It's time for new laws, no time for new wars. We come from the same God, cut from the same cord. Share the same pain and share the same skin. The march is still on, Luther's spirit lives on. It's a bedroom struggle and also a street struggle. Judge less and love more, stand up and stand tall. Talk tough or talk not, we gon' love and love more, yo. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is selfless. Love is faithful. Love is full of hope. Love is full of trust. Love is not proud. Love is God and God is love. According to the words of Loretta Young, love is not something you find. Love is something that finds you.
You can further annoy the Kenyan government by sharing Art Attack's Same Love Remix YouTube video. More queer Kenyan rap later in the program.
From Comedy Central's World News Headquarters in New York, this is The Daily Show with Trevor Noah.
Pastor James Manning has been a Comedy Central favorite, but someone else may get the last laugh at his Atla World Missionary Church. Daily Show correspondent Jessica Williams was surprised to get some seriously good news when she recently revisited Harlem's Herald of Homophobic Hate.
We'd met with the Reverend once in 2009.
Obama is indeed the next Hitler.
And again in 2015.
I think that Starbucks has recognized that the flavor of their lattes, that they are using semen to make that latte even more flavorful.
I sat down with Dr. Manning to find out what in the hell was going on this time.
The city of New York, the Blasio administration in particular, is trying to foreclose on our property over a damn water bill.
Have you been paying your water bill?
We're tax exempt. We're a church. Churches do not pay water bills or any other kind of tax for that matter.
Actually, that's bull. After a long legal battle, a 2007 Court of Appeals ruled that the church was ineligible for the water exemption. So that little thing, as well as over $1 million in separate claims against the church, prompted the foreclosure.
The Sodomites have launched a campaign over the last 2.5 years to try to silence my very vocal and truthful and commanding voice in this community. Many of them have moved up here to this particular community. Going uptown to Harlem, gonna let my hair down in Harlem.
I'm a sodomite, gonna go up to Harlem.
And have a good time.
And have a good old time.
And I have to say this as well. A lot of them came up here looking for black meat.
For what?
Black meat.
What is black meat?
Sex with black men.
Oh my God. Why do you say stuff like this?
I think jungle fever could be one of the terms.
I met with the man who wants to buy the property, Carl Siciliano. But it turns out he's not exactly planning to put up high-rise condos.
I run a program for homeless LGBT youth, kids that have been thrown out of their home. What I'd like to do is fill the building with young people who are currently sleeping in the streets.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Let me just wrap my head around this right now. You want to kick out a church that is very homophobic and put in young LGBT youth?
It's 3 blocks away from our drop-in center. It would be a perfect place for our young people to live.
What? That's amazing. That is great.
But the Reverend isn't concerned that the largest LGBT youth center in the country wants to move in, because he's carefully analyzed the legal proceedings and he's come to this logical conclusion.
Before this church is foreclosed,
sodomites will carry babies in their testicles for 9 months and then gestate them out of their assholes before this church is closed.
You're saying people are going to start having butt babies before this church is foreclosed then?
People are never going to have butt babies. So it's never going to happen.
So you're going to fight this thing?
Oh, absolutely.
But Dr. Manning, they're saying that you owe over $1 million. That is a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
You don't have the money, do you?
Aw, that's a shame. Well, when the auction comes, the forecast is for butt babies. And won't that be the ultimate twist?
You're having my baby. Oh, what a lovely way of saying how much you love me.
While The Daily Show's Jessica Williams awaits the arrival of Pastor James David Manning's butt babies, a lot more people have been showing how much they love queer youth by donating over $300,000 to the hashtag Harlem No Hate campaign for the purchase of Otla's church building. A restraining order has stayed the auction until late April, giving Carl Ciliano and his LGBT youth Ali Forney Center more time to arrange a deal. Stay tuned.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill, reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out.
Homophobia, turn me around, keep on walking, keep on talking.
We close our Kenyan rap package this week with a new single by lesbian artist Grammo Suspect called Our Love Is Valid. Like Art Attack, she's putting her career and maybe her life on the line to talk about the African continent's real LGBT history.
If I'd say that all my dreams are valid, I bet most of you will agree. But if I tell the details of the same dreams, funny most would disagree. We all got dreams under different grounds for me. Some about being a honoree and some erotic and exotic action to a very high degree. Through the hallway to the room that I lay, my partner makes a graceful entry. Foxy walk, a sexy smile, fine body, enticing booty covered by an elegant lingerie. I know, most of you expected another dress code, like a suit, maybe a tuxedo, and you'd rather a dungaree. So you shout nightmare, but in my dream you can't be a referee. But your noise don't stop my dream. I'm deaf, but not dumb, so I tell of this brie. Around her neck, wrist and waist, she wore appealing ornaments with filigree. Soothing, captivating smell is what hits me when she attacks and does things I could never dream. In no time I'm nude, not even with my spiritual pagari. Intimate journey of mutual consent in both parties that lead to a jamboree. What different kind of music features starring the chivalry. A major event with variety of food, mukimo, mbuta, biryani, even puri. We live happily ever after the executive ceremony that will kill with a French dance called Bori. I open my eyes with gladness, but is cut short by the news of this decree. Some head of state signed a bill using false concept as a pedigree. Has he forgotten the history of the court of Kabaka, King Mwanga? Ignorance earns no one a degree. Or maybe he don't know the concept among Nilotical Lango called Mokodo Dako. By now, he should be a retiree. Just like the stars, we shine and way too many to count 1, 2, 3. Some of us live frugally and hoard what you have, and others dissipated in a wild spree. Do you remember Akhenaten, the Egyptian pharaoh and Smenkari? Wow, that couple was over free. Astrologers, tradition healers were the terms in pre-colonial Burkina Faso. I'm not a chicory. Bian Nkuma, a transmitted medicine for wealth that was considered germ-free. All over Central Africa among Azande warriors, I'm not a filler tree. Check out ancient paintings of Bushmen. Don't they depict intimate activity? South African Chibari, Bahimas of Uganda, Oneki of Kikuyu, this is an African tree. Nzinga, a warrior woman in the Ndongo kingdom of the Bundu, ruled as a king. Kaya Free, the people of Buganda and Africa in general need to be set free. Free to dream, free to live the dream. We human, we can't live in a ree. Free will to live with whoever we dream of. We can't be tied to an axle tree. There are way too many gods. Hard to choose the real from the illusionary. Which one do I serve? Allah, Guy, the god of Agikuyu, Nyasai of the Luo, or the one of the Calvary? Different scriptures, even the Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda, claim to be following the word when sending people to the mortuary. A variety of cultures, some great, others pathetic. Female genital mutilation is slavery. A religious leadership role called Mugawe among Meru of Kenya existed way before missionary. Ganga Yatibanda, a priest of Gigs in the Congo, was contemporary. But all these gods, scriptures and cultures, shares love that is mandatory. Rainbow Way is all about love, free will in both parties, so don't compare it with burglary. And most of you do relate, so don't you act like the term homosexual is a vocabulary. If you're living in the closet or doing it behind your wife's back, your sons and daughters will have me to thank for bravery. I am biologically programmed within, beyond no choice, hence this is not temporary. And I'm not any less for a person in God's eyes. Pertaining his love and kingdom, I am a beneficiary. It's not a lifestyle. One has no choice. Not a fantasy, but an identity. Happens naturally, no forgery. Embracing the orientation is the only realistic route to mental health and happy living, shows discovery. Praises be to my maker, for I'm wonderfully and beautifully made. Quite the opposite of a mockery. Grimy suspect, I got too many clothes to find a place in the closet, hands out in the light. I am exemplary.
Grimy Suspect's Our Love is Valid single and video are available online. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones and Michael LeBeau contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. We featured Kenya's Art Attack and Grimy Suspect, and some of the other music you heard was by Corey Monteith. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KZSC Santa Cruz, California, WHRW Binghamton, New York, KPOV Bend, Oregon, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
Welcome back to listeners. How are you? So hopefully, if you're in Louisville, if you're in Kentucky, you know all about our wonderful new governor. If you're not in Kentucky, you probably heard about our wonderful new governor on the news somewhere. Matt Bevin has come in since he's been inaugurated in January, and he's caused quite the havoc in our state. He has proposed budget cuts that are going to really harm our state universities. He's suing Planned Parenthood of Kentucky. And so we're going to talk a little bit during Hot Topic Show about Matt Bevin, and then some really wonderful activists who are pushing back against Matt Bevin and all of his antics. So please welcome to the show today our friend Molly Shaw. How are you?
Good.
Molly, you are with Parents for Social Justice. Talk a bit about what is Parents for Social Justice, what do you all do, and then we'll talk more about your work getting even with Governor Bevin.
Sure. Parents for Social Justice is a organization to help parents, mainly those with young children, but any parents really, to get involved with progressive activism. Because when I had a kid, all of a sudden I couldn't do anything, and it was really frustrating.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to help people sort of from all ranges of the spectrum, people who have never done anything and their children have inspired them to be more activists, or people who were hardcore activists and just need some help.
Figure that out. And that's what I think is really cool, because I'm an activist, but I don't have any children. And so sometimes what I really appreciate about what we're doing with Black Lives Matter, Stand Up Sundays, Parents for Social Justice, is that it helps remind me that we have to make space for people with children, that there are people who are activists. And right. And so now we have meetings, for example, at Stand Up Sunday. Kids can come, kid-friendly spaces, kid-friendly food, coloring books. And so I love that PSJ makes space for people who perhaps can't come to a rally, but from their home computers can help do media outreach.
Yes.
Or you all can bake things. You all can do art projects. You all can even provide childcare or even help us figure out how we make our messages like Black Lives Matter relevant to young people.
Yes.
And so you're doing brilliant work with PSJ.
Thank you.
Part of that work has involves now a hashtag. What is the hashtag?
Well, it wasn't totally a PSJ thing. It was more a I had two bourbons and got mad at the governor thing.
There we go.
But it's called Ask Bevin About My Vag.
Okay.
Because apparently he wants to be all up in there. So I just had some questions for him.
And so just for some background, Matt Bevin recently signed into law a bill that required women to meet with their doctor at least 24 hours prior to having an abortion. Now, there's a lot of clinics that are even providing these services. And so Bevin and some other lawmakers recently made it where women have to consult with a doctor.
24
as
hours.
As if somehow they, I don't know if the desire is to be talked out of it. As if somehow, so I don't know what. But as you say, Matt Bevin, like many male legislators around the country, are trying to insert their own politics, no pun intended, into the uteruses and vaginas of women all around the nation.
Very much
and so,
so
you had a couple of bourbon and cokes or whatever, and you were like, But since Bevin wants to be all up in my stuff, let me then ask him a couple other questions.
Yeah, I had lots of questions. I mean, vaginas are really confusing, and like, governor's going to give me some information.
Your friends got on board. This went viral. This went national. Give our listeners an idea of some of the more PG-13 rated kind of tweets. That was one that was my favorite, and it said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's like a woman is in theory, the woman is speaking to the governor and saying, these are my questions, give me some advice.
Mm-hmm.
And so one woman says, I think that my period, like, it's coming to an end. Do you think that it's safe to wear my cute panties again?
Yeah.
You
know, so. I mean, I need to know that. That's a really big question for every
woman. What other kind of hashtags, what other kind of questions in the hashtag that you all ask? And y'all, these are really obviously tongue-in-cheek, and they're kind of laughable and absurd, but they really get to the notion of, like, you know so very little about women that I'm probably in a better position to decide about my health than the governor.
Yeah, or Planned Parenthood seems to have these answers, so it might be nice to ask them. We ask things like, you know, I have an IUD, and it seems to make me a little moody. Would if I got one that wasn't hormonal, would that help, Governor? we ask questions like, there were some serious questions too, like, I just had a miscarriage, should I grieve? Like, please let me know, Governor, because these are, you know, these are bodily integrity questions.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. And so in as much as they're designed to be funny and fun, as you just hinted, there is a side of seriousness to it. And so why was it important for you? Because it's not just for women who want to have abortions. It's not even just for women.
No.
This is an intersectional issue. This, you know, men are affected by reproductive justice, trans people, queer people. But why is this issue just important to you? And why did you feel the need to push back in such a public way?
It's just such a, like, it's a way to control women's bodies and to control bodies in general, and just the government control of bodies and the invasion of bodies. And the other bill that we didn't talk about, which is still, it hasn't been passed by the full legislature yet, is the transvaginal ultrasound bill, which is literally getting all up in your vag.
Okay, what does that bill seek to do?
You would have to have a transvaginal ultrasound.
What does that mean for people?
Which means you would insert a probe into your vagina to have an ultrasound. It's not necessary, and if it is necessary, your doctor will already recommend it, but usually it's not necessary to get an abortion to have that procedure. So, I mean, it's basically just state-sanctioned violence.
Vibe, yeah. Evan. See and you.
If you don't respect women and their health care, which is what this is, it's not respecting women and their doctors making their health care decisions, then they make poor health care decisions in the future, which leads to the need for more abortions. All of these bills are bills about controlling women and putting us back in the 1850s, not even the 1950s. You know, right. This is, that's what
Molly, thanks
about.
So much for being here. Please take care and come back anytime.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We want to welcome back to the city Garth Greenwell.
He's
the author of a new novella called What Belongs to You.
Yes, and he's a Louisville native.
Louisville native. I haven't had a chance to read much about it, but when I got here today, you told me that you found some parts really, you said it's right up my alley.
Oh my God,
because listeners know, who know a bit about me know that I kind of enjoy a little salaciousness.
Yes.
And as a boy who grew up in Kentucky in the 80s and 90s, much like the author, I had my own ideas about sex and desire and one's own self-discovery.
Yes.
So we're really excited today to be joined by Garth Greenwell. Welcome to the show, Garth. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Doc, you want to hop right into it?
Yes. So can you give our listeners, I don't want to give away like the story, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's an intense 3-part novella. It's extra spiced. And so I don't want to give away all of the spicy parts or details. But can you just give kind of a brief overview about your novella and, you know, the characters?
Sure. So the novel is about, it's set in Sofia, Bulgaria, where I lived from 2009 to 2013, working as a high school teacher. And it's about a relationship between an American teacher and a younger Bulgarian man whom he meets in this bathroom that is a cruising area, a place where gay men go for sex. And the narrator pays him for sex, which the narrator says is the first time he's ever done that. And the story of the novel is really how what seems at first like this very sort of easy transaction. I mean, like nothing could be clearer. I give you this, you give me that. Mm-hmm. How that actually becomes really complicated and messy. And the narrator finds himself caught by this man. I mean, he finds himself, I mean, really kind of in a kind of love with him. So that's the story of the book.
And it seems as if it's kind of a torturous love. Right? It's a reluctant love, right? It's there, but there are so many other factors with the character that are kind of pulling the main character away from that love and desire.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, in some sense, there's so much that separates the character, this Bulgarian man whose name is Mitko, from the narrator. I mean, there's nationality, there's class. The narrator is not in any way rich, but in this world, in Bulgaria, which is the poorest country in the EU, to have a high school salary, a high school teacher's salary, is to have a kind of material privilege that Mitko, who is almost homeless, that he can't imagine. There's language between them, because at the beginning of the novel, the narrator has just arrived. He can barely speak the language. Mitko doesn't speak English. They can barely communicate.
Wow.
And yet, you know, what interests me most, or what I was most interested in exploring, are these moments where, I mean, I hope the novel never pretends that all of that distance can be overcome. But there are points of contact. I mean, there are moments where the human feeling between these two people exceeds the sort of frame of sex work or the frame of foreignness or the frame of whatever. I mean, it has a potential to allow for contact across all of that distance.
So is it fair to call this body of work a love story? Would that be an appropriate, and the way that we know love, or that at least I have discovered love to be kind of messy, that we think that love stories are like The Notebook or some kind of Jennifer Lawrence film, when quite frankly, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I fall in love with a trade, right? So I know what it means to kind of meet somebody that isn't supposed to be your lover,
right?
And so is this sort of a love story, or is it more about sex and desire and all those other kind of messy details?
Well, yeah, I think it's about all of that, or I hope it's about all of that. And you know, one of the things that the narrator finds, because so the book is in 3 parts, and the first and the third part tell the story of this, of the relationship with Mitko. The second part is about Kentucky, and the second part is about the narrator's childhood and sort of coming of age as a gay person, and the sort of 2 relationships that kind of taught him about love. One of them is with his father, who, when his father finds out he's gay, he says, "You're not my son." He kicks him out of the house. And the other is with sort of his first love, who is this boy, his best friend. And they have sort of this moment of incredible intimacy. And then the best friend sort of protects himself by withdrawing from that and sort of asserts, you know, "I'm not what you are." Yeah. And those are the things that teach him about love. And so for him, you know, sex, desire, intimacy, love, this is really difficult territory. And those things are sort of in orbit, but they're not exactly aligned.
Certainly,
you know?
Yeah.
Now, is this based part and parcel on your own childhood in Kentucky? That did that happen to you, like it does in the main, the, you know, the main character of the novel who is rejected by their family?
Right.
Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the novel, it really kind of plays with this blurry territory between autobiography and fiction, because you know, the narrator is never named. Mitko is actually the only character in the book who has a name. But all of the kind of information we get about the narrator, anything you could sort of fact check, is true also of me. And so there's a way in which the novel is constantly playing with this idea of, like, is this fact? Is this fiction? What is? And that's sort of part of the fun for me. And I like books that do that. Part of the pleasure is kind of not knowing. That middle section, the stuff about Kentucky, I mean, that's pretty close to the bone. I mean, it was really hard to write about. I mean, I fled this place when I was 16, and you know, I really felt like this place was killing me. I mean, when I was 14, I had a high school teacher, the choir director at the Youth Performing Arts School, who heard something in my voice and started giving me lessons and gave me art as a way to really escape a situation that was, I think that was killing me. You know, I mean, gay kids die all the time.
Yeah,
in this
and especially
country.
When you think about, I see in your notes, we're probably of a very similar age, especially in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is pre Ellen, this is pre Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh, yes. Out. Oh,
and then
this is
the time pre Fairness Ordinance.
It was. This is the time of Matthew Shepard and Brandon Tino, where kids are literally either being killed and or taking their own lives.
Absolutely.
So I think for our younger listeners who probably can't contextualize a time period where literally you can feel like you're dying just
Absolutely.
Because you're living in what was Louisville in the 80s and the 90s. So I can certainly empathize with that.
So
through art, you found your escape.
And that's
that
right.
was through music
that's
then.
Right.
It's through writing now. So after you leave Kentucky at 16, you go where?
So I went, this choir teacher told me about this school called the Interlochen Arts Academy in Northern Michigan, which is a school for the arts. And, you know, I mean, that place, I mean, really did save my life because, you know, when you were being a gay kid in the early 90s was actually, and this is the spark of my book, is very similar to being a gay kid in Bulgaria today. And what that means is that you are taught one lesson about your life, and that lesson is your life has no dignity, your life has no value. And it was in art. It was in books when I found James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room and Edmund White's A Boy's Own Story. And it was in music that I sort of was first given a different image of myself. And, you know, David Brown at the Youth Performing Arts School was the first adult in my life to suggest my life had value. And that saved my life. I went to Interlochen, and then I went on from there to the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. I went from there, I started studying poetry, I got an MFA at WashU, I went to Harvard and did half of a PhD in poetry, and then I decided I didn't want to be an academic, I didn't want to be a professor, and I started teaching high school, and I spent 3 years teaching in Ann Arbor. And
oh,
then,
that's where I'm originally from.
Oh, are you from Michigan?
I'm from Ann Arbor.
Yeah, you know, it is the most beautiful place.
Everyone loves Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
Well, I taught at Green Hills School. You may know that Green Hills
yes.
School in Ann Arbor for 3 years. And then I made this leap to this place I knew nothing about. I had never been to Eastern Europe. And I went to Bulgaria and fell in love with the place. And I kept having this weird experience as I met queer people there of sort of, you know, being in this really foreign, strange place where I didn't understand anything and meeting people who were telling me exactly the same stories of what it meant to be queer that I heard in Kentucky when I was 14.
I was just going to ask you about that. How did the relationships and friendships and people you met and the dynamics about LGBT stuff differ or were similar in Bulgaria?
Because we often think about international. We see ourselves as Westerners or Americans. Mm-hmm. It's so vastly different from people from other countries or sometimes even other states. And so although there's a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier perhaps, you found some universal truths about what it meant to be a queer person and someone who was othered. What were some of those truths? What were some of those similarities? And as Dr. Story asked, like, what were some of the differences, I guess, that you had to navigate?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the first kind of universal experience was a place. That was my novel begins in this bathroom, which is a real place. It's a very famous cruising place beneath the National Palace of Culture in Sofia. And
I'm writing that down, by the way. Yeah. Sofia. Okay.
Oh, I can set you up.
Thank you.
But yeah, so and I found that place totally by accident. I didn't know about it. Maybe my third week in the country. And it was the strangest experience because, as I say, I mean, I barely could say hello and how are you in Bulgarian. And, you know, I was constantly making these faux pas because I didn't understand sort of how people interacted. Since all that's very different. And then I descended into this place and it's you have to go down a lot of stairs to get to it. And automatically I felt like I was fluent. I felt like I understood. I was able to communicate because cruising culture was exactly the same.
Yeah,
I mean, that bathroom worked exactly like Cherokee Park when I was 14.
Certainly, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that was one thing. But then, you know, what was amazing was as I started to be able to speak the language and as I started to meet people, to talk to these queer people and have them, you know, talk about their lives in a way that was exactly the way that, you know, the first gay men I met in Cherokee Park and other places, I mean, it's like they had the same horizon of possibility for their lives. And that was really, you know, Bulgaria joined the EU in 2007, which gave queer people all sorts of rights and protections they had never had before. But it is an incredibly conservative place. And so like Kentucky in the early 90s, there's a pride parade and there is an LGBT rights organization. But the culture is just overwhelmingly homophobic.
Yeah. Garth, lots of people write about LGBTQ narratives, mythographies, biographies, but very few, I think, folks talk about issues of sex and desire in such a frank way. I mean, certainly we've talked in the show about what's called public sex environments, and we know, but a lot of gay people try to shy away from, the seediness of it. Why was it important for you to very, very directly take on the notion of a trick and a date, talk about a bathhouse, things that a lot of authors try to sanitize and avoid? It's more about love. You're like, no, it's about sex and desire, and sometimes those things are synonymous, and sometimes they're not.
That's right.
And sometimes my sex is indiscriminate, and sometimes I just... So talk to me a bit about how you got to a place where you wanted to write in that way, and then why it's important to tell that particular narrative as opposed to some of the other narratives we get about LGBTQ life.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Absolutely, because, you know, right now I feel like in America, the dominant narrative about LGBT life is the narrative of marriage equality.
Yeah.
You know, and that is a very particularly packaged narrative. And, you know, I think marriage equality is important. I think it was an important battle. I think it's important that queer people have access to that model of life. I think it's tragic that that battle was fought at the expense of so many other issues in which LGBTQ lives are at risk. And I think it's tragic that as part of that media campaign, the most vulnerable and marginalized parts of the LGBTQ community were further marginalized and made more vulnerable. That seems to me tragic. Cruising has been at the center of my life since I was 14. And those places, which have been so despised by, you know, both straight and queer authorities, are places of extraordinary human richness. They're places where people have face-to-face contacts and encounters that engage the full range of possible ethical response. And it seems to me that it's also in those places that a lot of what I think of as really the radical potential of queerness persists. You know, because those are places that scramble the usual categories by which we organize our lives. They're places that scramble categories of class. They're places that scramble categories of race. They're places that scramble, you know, all of these. You know, it's amazing that in America we have created a society in which rich people never see poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And we've created a society that's segregated in these devastating ways. And these queer spaces have always been places where people from incredibly different worlds have encounters. And anytime that happens, there's the possibility of a kind of ethical spark. Mm-hmm. There's the possibility for contact. There's the possibility for compassion. I don't want to romanticize these spaces. You know, there are also places where people are used in instrumental ways and assaulted and robbed and all of these things. But they are places where I have experienced, you know, intimacy as great as any intimacy I've known in my life. Mm-hmm. And you know, and something that I would call love, and that I think, you know, I think those places are communities. I think they're sustaining, and I think they deserve that value and that dignity that art bestows.
Mm, I loved that. I mean, yes. I mean, I just, oh, that like gave me chills. I mean, I've always, I mean, as a lesbian, I've always been, you know, profoundly, I would say, envious of the fact that queer men have been able to create probably since the beginning of gay folks.
Yeah,
I
right.
mean,
yeah.
You know, all the way back in 17th, 16th centuries, I'm sure there were cruising spots
and
PSEs, right? I mean, and, you know, lesbians don't have that kind of public space, right? They don't have the online stuff that gay men have created, the Adam for Adam or the Grinders or the Jacked, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, why do you look at me as you think of that, as if somehow I know
what does
all
that
the,
mean?
The
no, because I want to make sure I get the yes. they get the names right and, right and stuff did. Like that. And me and Jay talk about this all the time as really good friends, and how those options aren't necessarily out there or available to lesbian women. But I do. I love them for gay men. And everything you just said, I've always felt that way. And I do feel like they have a huge stigma attached to them.
Yeah.
And I feel like people... make them, and you know, put and project all this morality onto those
Absolutely.
Spaces and judgment that to me is just nothing but pure homophobia and, you know, quite frankly, jealousy as well.
Well, Dr. Story, I mean, you're someone who teaches classes about sexuality and you're a sex positive professor. What is the value in having the frankness, the realness of sex or desire as part of our identities as queer people? Like, you know, what is the value in works like What Belongs to You? And you and I often talk intimately about kind of what is the value in embracing our full selves as sexual people, as people who have desire, rather than just people who want to get married, right? And that's okay
yes.
if you do.
Yes.
But that somehow we have to erase our sexuality and even like kind of even some kind of like the sex that ain't like vanilla.
Well, the thing that I really enjoyed about the novella, you know, profoundly so, was the frontness and the forwardness of pleasure as a part of sex and desire. And I feel like, especially now, we're living in a society that we want to kind of get rid of sex ed in school. We do sex ed when it is happening way too late in school.
Yeah.
And we always teach it to children and young people through these lenses of morality, judgment, and fear. Pleasure is never a frame of reference when it comes to desire and sex, and it's only until we become adults and take responsibility for our own sexual lives then do we even explore the possibilities that most people understand sex to be either service or sacrifice, right? Mm. You're either doing it for someone else or you're sacrificing for someone else, but pleasure should be the primary impetus for that, right?
Yeah.
And I see PSEs and public sex environments as having that at the forefront. It's a freeing space in that way. And anytime there is freedom, there's also pleasure. So, I mean, that's what I really enjoyed, particularly about the story. And even though the love affair between the two characters is difficult and trying and, no, leave him alone. You know, I mean, there's those parts, too. I still very much liked the pure desire that I think every human being has within them that is afraid oftentimes, that's either been told to suppress that, to repress that, to get rid of that, to pray it away. I mean, and I feel like that's profound. It's wrong. It's wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree.
So, yeah.
Well, and you know, I mean, for all that in America today, you know, queer narratives are more present than they've ever been in the wider culture. And, you know, there's an acceptance of certain models of gay life that I certainly could never have imagined when I was 14 in Kentucky. It is still very much a culture that despises the queer body. And it's a culture that despises the queer sexual body. And, you know, that's one reason why it was so important to me to put that body on the page and to write sex explicitly in this book. Because again, to write about something is to make a claim about it. And it's a claim that it has value. And to me, you know, writing the queer sexual body with all of the resources, these extraordinary resources of the literary tradition, the resources of poetry, that's a way of cherishing that body.
Yeah.
It's a way of declaring its value.
And I completely agree, because while we do have all of this visibility when it comes to LGBT relationships and all of this, like I think about one of my favorite shows now that always makes me cry every episode because it kind of tugs at your heartstrings, The Fosters, for instance. It's about a lesbian couple who have all of these racially diverse children that they foster, some of whom they've adopted. One of the moms had them biologically. They never have sex. And any hint of sexuality is them holding hands in the bed at the end of the night, both exhausted. And I'm like, what kind of, I mean, this is like, who wants to sign up for that type of relationship? Honey? I mean, I wasn't, you know, exploring my sexuality in my youth as a lesbian, thinking about growing up to hold hands with a woman. So yeah. I feel like, where is this coming from? And I know that, and that's exactly what your kind of book speaks against, that sanitize, what Jay was speaking about, sanitizing queer life and queer sex and making it just full of romance and about love, and we love too, and we're the same. And it's like, no, our sex isn't the same.
Right.
It's not. The way that we meet, the way we hook up, the way that we have sex, it's completely different, and that's okay.
It's okay.
Difference is okay.
It's okay.
Right? Yeah. So,
well, how has your return to Kentucky been? Have you been well-received? Have you been enjoying your readings and your signings? How is Kentucky different now than it was when you left?
Oh, I mean, it's very different. It's been really intense to be back. I came back in May. My youngest sister got married. That was the first time I'd been back in more than a decade.
Okay.
It's clearly a different city. There's a different energy. You know, there's obvious, I mean, the fact that this show exists, is a different world,
yes, absolutely.
Right? It's a different world. Thank goodness. There have been a lot of feelings. And, you know, I mean, it has been reading from the book here. Like, I did a reading at Carmichael's. And, you know, in the front row, there was my mother.
Oh, goodness.
And two of my sisters and my stepmother. And then that teacher from high school, that choir director who saved my life. And, you know, I could see all of them. Even as I was looking down at the page, I could see them in my peripheral vision. I could see when my mother got uncomfortable, you know, like, I mean, all of that. And that's just, you know, that's weird. But, you know, I expected the bad feelings, the hard feelings. I didn't expect all the wonderful feelings, you know. I mean, since I left this place at 16, I've moved basically every 2 or 3 years. And so to be in a place where, like, I can see, you know, when I come downtown, I can see a building and I can remember my father taking me there when I was 5 years old. That's powerful, you know. And I mean, you know, I'm glad I left this place, and I'm glad, you know, I got to places where I was able to learn different lessons about myself. But you lose some